I'm going to talk a little later about the parts of that I identify with, but you know it's not fashion forward. Principals tend to use lofty language to describe lofty goals. And when some of our newest members last spring, after the new UU classes, suggested that we follow up by looking at the principals in a little bit more depth, that maybe their introduction had gone by a little quickly, and then when the worship team discussed it and decided, boy, that would be a good theme for this year, going through the principles in depth, I got nervous. My experience is that we have a very limited tolerance as a society for talking about principles. They get consigned to philosophy classes and a certain group of political speeches, maybe, that we listen to for more about what they make us feel about the candidate than actual content of the principles. So I wondered what you were looking for from me when this became our theme for the year. Well, I guess we're going to begin finding out today, because this is my first chance to explore the first principle of the seven that all of the nation's more than 1,000 Unitarian Universalist congregations pledge to affirm and to promote. Of the seven, this affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person — everyone matters in the kids' version, but inherent worth and dignity of every person in the adult version — is the one we are most likely to nail word for word in conversations with non-UUs. It's our most familiar life jacket when we're plunged into the sea of, what do UUs believe? Oh, the inherent worth and dignity of every individual. It's the first thing that comes to mind for a lot of us, seriously. And it's not the first thing we say, though. When people ask us, what do UUs believe, we tend to respond first with what we don't believe. We say, we don't have a unifying creed about God or the afterlife or any other typical religious concern. So that often leads next into the conversation to someone saying, so you don't believe in anything? And then lifelong UUs, like me, are not sure they're really serious. So we tend to respond with UU jokes that kind of affirm that we have no group belief. You know, things like, why did the UU cross the road? To support the chicken in its search for its own path. But if after something like that, the questioner is still looking like they're interested in what we believe, you know, we tend to respond something like, our congregations have seven principles reflecting what we hope all UUs will share as values, things like honoring the inherent worth and dignity of every man. And then we start to think, do I remember the second one? And then sometimes we skip to the seventh, because the ones in between are kind of hard for most of us to remember if we haven't studied. But that's the truth. When we get serious with declaring why we exist collectively and what we encourage each other to do when we're acting individually, it's that we all believe in the incalculable value of human life. And so that always leads the non-UU to ask, what about Hitler? Even Hitler? Now, sometimes current events intervene. Today you might hear people saying, what about Trump? But it really all comes back to what about Hitler? And the answer for me demands wrestling with God, which might surprise some of you, because neither the name God nor any idea of a supreme being appears in the literal words of the first principle. The principle, though, is descended from Bible passages linking human identity to the nature of God. And Jason has shared some of those passages with you, including those famous words very early in the Hebrew Bible that we are created in the image of God. A nearby passage, which we didn't include today, says that that's not true just of Adam and Eve, man and woman, he created them both, but it's true of all their descendants. So, we come from an ancient faith that humans are endowed with unique elements of our being that are eternally precious to God, or life with a capital L, if that's the way you prefer to think about it. But it's not just precious to each of us for our own sake. This isn't worth that we've earned, or dignity society is called upon to recognize because of how we've lived, all of the good and wonderful things we've done. It's worth and a claim to be treated with dignity that comes out of the womb with each of us. Now, our second biblical reading, we loved because he first loved us. Well, that was just like amen clickbait, if there had been clickbait in the days of our Universalist forebears. They loved that passage. The Universalists were those Christian heretics, I hope you recall, who preached that no one ends up in hell forever. The supreme being that they found as they read their Bible was above all else a God of love, too powerful to be defeated by Satan or any other evil force. Image of God meant to them that we are all born from and for love. Humans might be crushed by circumstances, their own shortcomings, by oppression, but their God loved eternally to a degree that was beyond our understanding. Indeed, it was the very definition of God for the Universalists. How could anyone ever really say a person is worthless if God values every person, every last person, enough to bring them to heaven, no matter what happened in their lives? When the Unitarians and the Universalists merged in 1961, after a century of coming together, going apart, coming together, they finally merged in 1961. They approved six principles of agreement. And the third one, not the first one, the third one read that UUs would affirm, defend, and promote the supreme worth of every human personality, the dignity of man, and the use of the democratic method in human relationships. Note the words supreme worth. By the time the six principles were revised into seven in 1985 to, among other things, rid them of sexism, the delegates at that General Assembly were also shedding language pointing directly to Christian and Jewish worship of a supreme being controlling the universe. So, supreme worth was reframed as inherent worth. The democracy in human relationships language in that third principle was moved to another principle, and the secular humanist remnants of that third principle were elevated to the first principle in 1985. So this current version of the principle opens up a simple answer to the Hitler question. It goes something like this. Well, Hitler was born with the potential to be a blessing and chose otherwise. At some point, he became virtually worthless on balance and maybe even moved into negative worth. Clearly, we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of humans by seeking to eliminate our Hitlers and close their death camps. But watch out. This actually unfolds with an interim step. To keep our principle pure, we dehumanize the people we are excluding from it. And we start talking about them as animals or beasts or scum. Now, I'm glad that the ancient religion of supreme worth is gone from our principles, but I know that that principle in that language stiffened the spine of countless reformers who struggled to eliminate abuses like slavery. And that kind of language still is a bulwark for religious human rights activists. So I worry about where the secular humanists among us, the pure secular humanists among us, are left, especially since that dodgy habit of dehumanizing is intensifying with the spread of social media. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., one of those people we claim is a Unitarian because he was christened that way but never actually practiced Unitarianism as an adult, but he sometimes claimed that way, wrote a century ago, "A word is not a crystal, transparent and unchanged. It is the skin of a living thought and may vary greatly in color and content according to the circumstances and the time in which it is used." Now, the legal opinion in which he wrote this, he was struggling for how to interpret the word income. But I think what he wrote is true for all the words in our principles, all the important ones, and it's especially true for inherent in this first principle. If inherent worth is read as a product of evolution rather than God's will, it certainly doesn't imply enduring and precious. That's not how evolution works. And it certainly doesn't mean superior to other forms of worth in our life. It's just inherent. It's there at the beginning. So I hope you see the slippery slope we stand on when each of us is the soul. That's the S-O-L-E soul, not the S-O-U-L soul. The sole judger of worth, just as we define our own visions of the sacred. Maybe that's what's going on, and whether or not we acknowledge it, it's just us and has to be if worth and dignity are no more than subjective human ideas. The current wording is arguably more honest and more humble in pushing divinity out of the discussion, not viewing ourselves as the nearest living relatives of the eternal supreme being, frees us up to ask if the word person in that principle ought to be replaced by being, the inherent worth and dignity of every being. That amendment to the first principle would expand our call to one that affirms and promotes all forms of life. It's a red-hot subject of debate now in UU circles, and we're going to explore it more in May when I get to the end of looking at each of the principles and we talk about proposed revisions that people are currently wrestling with in them. But it doesn't even represent the personhood frontier these days. I don't know how many of you saw the news article, but in July, the Supreme Court of Bangladesh ruled that the nation's rivers have personhood and that people could be sued for damaging their right to exist. And this stream of thinking about whether the objects of nature also have personhood or ought to before the law is an active one. So here we are on that slope with many, I don't know, perhaps most of you, striving to be good without God. How does our current first principle call on all of us, God folk and atheists alike, to act as blessers, healers, and benders of the universe toward justice? I want to name a few things that we could agree reflect the first principle in action, and they're surprisingly simple. We actually do a lot of this without even really thinking about it. So let's start with our annual fire drill. Now, I know you're used to me giving surprise cues for Lynn to trip the fire alarm, and then we do our fire drill by walking across to Martha's lawn. Now, that's not what's gonna happen today. You're gonna have to sit here. It's a beautiful day to go to Martha's lawn, I know, but, and I'm not going to go through all the details, reminding you of how we do the fire drill. You know, if I'm not here, then you listen to the worship associate, and you listen to the person in the yellow vest who's our safety attendant, and we do things like make sure that people who are mobility impaired go last, because although in your panic you might want to get everybody out, all the studies show the room empties fastest and is safest for everybody if the people who can go fastest go first. All those little details. I'm not going to go into all of that because we're not going to do the fire drill. You're going to read about it in the November newsletter, right? Do I have everybody agreeing? Okay. What I want to point out, though, is that we have a safe congregations team that shepherds us towards acting like we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And whether it's keeping us up to date on those best practices for safety drills or recommending policies to protect one child in our midst with a life-threatening peanut allergy. This is something we do collectively. We also have a caring network that looks out at what we can do for the group and looks out at what we can do for individuals. So for instance, the caring network is now working on getting contributions to gas and grocery cards for the Singh family, while Ian goes through some very serious cancer treatment. And if you want to pursue that, you can talk to Nita afterwards downstairs. The point is that we do all of this day in, day out, we honor the inherent worth of every individual and how we care for each other in the congregation in lots of ways that we think about and lots of ways that we don't realize that this is what's going on. It happens also financially in the life of this congregation. We don't have dues, but we do an annual pledge drive, and that starts with a visit to people in their homes to talk about how they feel about the congregation. And then when they pledge, that information is kept private as possible. Even the person receiving the pledge doesn't look at what it is. And if people can't meet their pledge, then we make it clear to them that we sympathize and they're still welcome here in everything that we do. You also do this collectively when you give me a discretionary fund to help homeless people or other people down on their luck with no questions asked and no reporting who that is. This is all ways that we respect the inherent worth and dignity of every person financially. And one last example, we have a rainbow flag and a Black Lives Matter flag flying outside of our church. There are others who have the rainbow flag. We're the only church in town with a Black Lives Matter banner. And what we're saying with that is, as a congregation, we affirm that we live in and benefit from the history of a society that has oppressed people of color for hundreds of years, and even today, they are exploited because of the legacy of that and all too often murdered without legal consequences. And so we put that banner out there not to say all lives matter, but not to not say all lives matter, but to say if you're going to say all lives matter, you start with saying the people whose lives are being treated like they don't matter, and then the rest of it goes without saying. This is an old idea. Jesus said it in the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew, what you do for the least of my brothers and sisters, you do for me. I think our banner actually says it more comprehensively because it invites Americans to include non-Christians into the common understanding of human worth. But I reject the idea that the first principle challenges us to draw a circle so wide that you can find something to honor Hitler about, and that principle of always looking, how far can I expand it, is what the first principle is calling us to. My challenge and yours is to not let everyday irritants shut down our instinct to sense something worthy of worship in each of us. This is what Poppy was talking about with the children, and I want you to think about it for a minute. Yeah, you can worry about Hitler, and everywhere where we see someone like that arising in our world today, yes, please worry and do something about it. But you're much more likely to encounter ugly elements that shut down your ability to honor the inherent worth and dignity of everyone in George Carlin's Modern Man, elements of it in yourself and other loved ones. If by low life we mean selfishness, denial of our role in climate change, and similar sins, who isn't to some extent living the high-tech low-life he refers to? My inner child has been outward bound at the wrong time every now and then, I admit it. Some of you have experienced me in what he called rude dude flashes. I've encountered people who are out of rehab and in denial, as have almost all of you, hyperactive and radioactive, and we all know well what an alpha male looks like acting in destructive ways. When the failings are mine, the switch in me, primed to affirm and promote any inherent worth and dignity of others, it's kind of dimmed down. Sometimes it's actually dimmed down into the off position. But even if you or I escape the toxic forms of modern manism and its other gender equivalents, even if we somehow manage to pass through a patch of sainthood in our lives, I don't think we need to be vain enough to think that we are in control. We can be at our very best and find our best efforts foiled by others, seen and unseen, and often they're foiling us without actual intent. They are just making it really hard for us to honor inherent worth and dignity. If the first principle is a step on a ladder to our aspirations, it's a big one, and we are constantly slipping and being knocked off of it. Now, since Linus is here, without his permission, I'm telling one of our earliest family stories. When he was just a toddler, he walked up, or he crawled up, to an electrical outlet. And Michelle and I watched him looking at the electrical outlet, contemplating whether to put his finger in it, and then shaking his head, because somewhere he'd heard that you don't put your finger in an electrical outlet. That's the commandment stage. And it's interesting, in the Bible, we get commandments before we get principles. Commandments are what we do as children. Principles are what we wrestle with as adults. So we gather as a congregation in the adult stage of dealing with who we are and how we're supposed to act. And that is really rough. That is really rough to do day in, day out. So my prayer for you is a really simple one today. It's that we can somehow lay claim to that very last element in George Carlin's boastful rap. Let us be built to last as a congregation and be people in this world who strive to make these principles real. Blessed be. Amen.